The headlines, Israeli settlers backed by troops storm a Palestinian village near the West Bank city of Nablus, setting house on fire. Ukraine launches new drones into Russia a day after targeting the capital Moscow with unmanned aircraft. And at a summit of South American leaders, the Brazilian president calls for the creation of a common regional currency. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour is Israeli settlers backed by the regime's forces have carried out yet another raid on the occupied West Bank. Local Palestinian sources say the settlers fired live rounds indiscriminately at homes in Jalud village south of the city of Nablus. The sources say Palestinian youths tried to defend the village, leading to an exchange of fire that is still ongoing. Some Palestinians have sustained injuries so far. Zionist settlers have also reportedly set a Palestinian house on fire in Jalud. The Israeli regime has intensified its raids across the occupied territories in recent months. Nearly 150 Palestinians have lost their lives in Israeli attacks in the West Bank alone this year so far. Elsewhere, the lawyer of Hamid Nouri, an Iranian national jailed in Sweden for alleged rights abuses, has told Press TV about his situation. Thomas Bodström says the court lacks competence to hear the accusations leveled against his client.
First of all, this is a very strange case. I cannot understand why we should have a trial in Sweden about what happened in another country 35 years ago from a person who is not a Swedish person, what he maybe have done to other people who are not Swedes at all. So that nothing to do with Sweden.
Bodström said Nouri's trial has not been, quote, fair. It has had so many mistakes. He said some of the witnesses introduced against the defendant have had conflict of interest in the case. The lawyer said Nouri should be acquitted despite all the evidence brought up against him. Bodström said his client lost valuable documents required for defense due to what the court claims to be erasing by mistake. The lawyer slammed Swedish authorities for not allowing Nouri to visit his family members. He said Nouri is entitled by law to have in-person visitations. Bodström said his client has now spent more than 3.5 years in solitary confinement. He said the long period was a, quote, record in Sweden.
And what I am most upset about is that he is almost isolated 24 hours a day. And now he has been there for more than 3.5 years. This will be his fourth summer in custody if they don't let him go out, which I hope they will. But so this is the worst part, because he is isolated for 7 square meters. And, okay, we can come and visit him, but we cannot go more than once a week or once a week, because we are just lawyers and we are working with the case. And he has asked for new glasses so he can read better. Since we came into the case, it's almost 8-9 months. Nothing has happened. So he is treated very bad. And we complain about it all the time, but nothing happened.
Nouri was arrested upon arrival in Stockholm in November 2019. Swedish prosecutors accuse him of involvement in the execution of members of the Mojahedin-e-Khalq terrorist organization. The group is responsible for killing at least 17,000 Iranians. Tehran has rejected the accusations against Nouri as politically motivated. The United Arab Emirates says it has pulled out of the U.S.-led Combined Maritime Forces Coalition 2 months ago. The UAE Foreign Ministry in a statement said the move was the result of an ongoing evaluation of effective security cooperation with all its partners. The statement added that Abu Dhabi remains committed to dialogue and diplomatic engagement to advance regional security and stability, as well as ensure navigation safety in accordance with international law. The U.S. has not commented on the withdrawal of the UAE from the so-called Combined Maritime Forces established in 2001. The coalition is a 34-nation task force which is being supervised by the U.S. naval base in Bahrain alongside the American Navy's Fifth Fleet and Central Command. Ukraine has stepped up its attacks inside Russia as well as Russian-held territories in the country's eastern regions. A Moscow-installed official in the Flashpoint Luhansk region says shelling of a village left at least four civilians dead and over a dozen others injured. Inside Russia, authorities say four people were injured in Ukrainian shelling of a border town. The attacks reportedly targeted homes, a school, as well as industrial facilities. Separately, a Ukrainian drone sparked a fire at an oil refinery in southern Russia. Local officials say the blaze was soon extinguished and left no casualties. There was no immediate information on who launched the drone, but Moscow has accused Kiev of such attacks in recent weeks. There were similar drone attacks on Moscow on Tuesday, which Russian President Vladimir Putin described as terrorist acts.
We already mentioned the possibility of carrying strikes against decision-making centers. And of course, one of them is the headquarters of Ukrainian military intelligence, which we attacked two or three days ago. In response, the Kyiv regime chose another route. They are trying to scare Russia, scaring the people of Russia, and carrying out strikes against residential buildings. This is a clear sign of terrorist activity.
Tuesday's strikes targeted several areas, including a suburb where the Russian president has an official residence. The Kremlin says at least two people were injured during the assault, but most of the drones were intercepted by the country's air defenses. A Ukrainian presidential aide has denied Kiev's involvement in the attacks, but said his country was, quote, enjoying watching events and forecast more to come. Our correspondent Johnny Miller joined us from Moscow to give us more on the latest developments in the Ukraine war.
In the Luhansk region particularly, the United Kingdom recently gave Ukraine Storm Shadow missiles, which enables Ukraine to strike further into Luhansk region, even hitting Luhansk city itself, and they've been striking some military targets there. But there's been some speculation that Ukraine is attacking the Belgorod region, even Moscow, perhaps in preparation, trying to confuse Russia in preparation for this apparent counteroffensive that many people have been talking about for months now. We're certainly seeing a step up of attacks by Ukraine and Russia. Meanwhile, has frequently said that it's only just started in Ukraine and has a lot more power in reserve. So we'll have to wait and see whether Russia uses any of that power. And we're also waiting to see this Ukrainian counteroffensive. A lot in this conflict will be decided by success or lack of success of that.
Turkey has been blocking Sweden's attempts to join the NATO alliance for months. Now, following the re-election of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Europe and Washington need to consider a new strategy to get the nod from Ankara for Sweden's accession to the Western alliance. Robert Carter reports on the latest from the Swedish capital.
Will Sweden ever succeed in its bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, otherwise known as NATO? That is the question many are wondering after a year of back and forth on the contentious issue. The US and other NATO members have lobbied hard for a fast-tracked introduction of several Scandinavian countries in a move that deeply angered Russia. Finland's bid was successful. Sweden's, on the other hand, ran into serious problems.
Sweden and Finland both applied to join NATO last year, abandoning their traditional policies of neutrality following the start of the Ukraine conflict. Now, in order to successfully join NATO, all of its current members must support the bid. Turkey and also Hungary have yet to support Sweden's application to join the military alliance.
Turkey ratified Finland's accession in late March, but has blocked Sweden's over complaints Stockholm harbours members of groups Ankara considers terrorists. Relations between the two worsened in January when Quran burnings outside Turkey's embassy in Sweden sparked global Muslim protests. European onlookers hoped that the recent Turkish elections might open the door to NATO if Erdogan loses. Instead, he remains in power. US President Joe Biden is now forced to find an alternative strategy, possibly by enticing Ankara with promises of fighter jet sales.
I spoke to Erdogan and congratulated Erdogan, and he still wants to work on something on the F-15s. I told him we wanted to deal with Sweden until I get that done, and so we'll be back in touch with one another. But it was basically a congratulatory call.
Critics of NATO believe any move to expand the bloc is a mistake. casting doubt on NATO's true ambitions.
I was looking up some polls earlier, and throughout the last centuries, the Swedes were very opposed to NATO membership. They wanted to maintain that independence, but it's all been shifted on its head thanks to very smart propaganda. Just looking back on history, in 1999, they decided to become an offensive organisation with the bombing of Yugoslavia. They have been involved in numerous other conflicts since, especially in Afghanistan and also Libya. They are not a defensive alliance.
NATO's Secretary General has expressed high hopes Sweden will indeed join the bloc. Swedish Foreign Minister said Monday he hoped to meet with his Turkish counterpart soon to discuss relations. However, Moscow has warned that the continued expansion of NATO could lead to further retaliatory measures, raising fears of further fighting in Europe. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
Today marks the birth anniversary of Imam Reza, the eighth Shia Imam. Pilgrims from around the world have converged on the northeastern Iranian city of Mashhad to visit Imam Reza's shrine and pay homage to him on this day. Our correspondent, Gisu Mishahadi, is joining us now with more details on this day. Gisu, tell us more about what's going on behind you.
Well, Badia, as you mentioned yourself, it's a very important occasion. It is the birthday anniversary of the eighth Shia Imam, Imam Reza, peace be upon him. It is considered an auspicious occasion for Muslims, and that is why the city of Mashhad is the most crowded it has ever been, with tourists pouring in, not only from different parts of Iran, Badia, but also from regional countries and even countries from outside the region. Muslims are coming to visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza that you see right behind me. The shrine of Imam Reza is now the place where everyone wants to be at, especially on this day, to take part in the mass prayers and different ceremonies that are being held. Now, I have to note that the ceremonies pertaining to the birthday of Imam Reza started last. Actually, it started with this street that you see behind me being closed down, route being prepared for pilgrims and walk towards the Reza. And well, it was quite an interesting scene to watch. 8 kilometers to walk is not very short, Badia. It's quite a long route. And for us, it took us about 3.5 hours to walk down this street, where there were different also stalls offering treats, offering food, and also all kinds of services that anyone...
All right, unfortunately, we lost that connection. That was our correspondent, Gisu Mishahadi, joining us from the city of Mashhad. Moving on, divisions grow in the EU over the bloc's relentless military support for Ukraine. EU member Hungary favors peace negotiations, and that stance is creating tensions, as our Brussels correspondent Jerome Hughes now reports.
EU leaders accused the Hungarian government of casting democratic values aside with respect to judicial reforms and press freedom. However, analysts say their real issue is that Budapest is not towing the line with respect to the war in Ukraine. EU affairs ministers met on Tuesday to debate so-called EU values in Hungary. On her way into the meeting, Hungarian Justice Minister Judit Varga slated the European Parliament for criticising her government. Minister Varga says that the European Parliament does not respect EU values, does not respect democracy in Hungary, does not respect rule of law. What do you think?
The European Parliament has full democratic legitimacy to adopt the resolutions in case they see the political need to do so. So that's the only comment I have.
The EU has so far spent €10 billion on weapons for Ukraine. EU nation Hungary is against the policy, and that seriously irks Brussels and Washington.
There is no chance to win this war. So therefore, what we should do far more energy invest into to convince everybody that the only solution is ceasefire.
Experts say Prime Minister Orban is correct to suggest the EU is concentrating too much on propelling the Ukraine war.
He definitely has a point, because here in Brussels you hear people saying, okay, it's always about Ukraine, it's Ukraine this, Ukraine that, but we should not forget the Palestinians in Gaza. We should not forget the Syrians. We should not forget the Sudanese.
It's clear the Hungarian government is a major thorn in the side of the EU project at present. However, Eurosceptic parties in other member states are on course to make significant gains in forthcoming elections, helped on by the cost of living crisis. Therefore, the problems might only be starting for the establishment here. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Brazil's President Lula da Silva has called on South American countries to create a common currency in the region. Lula said rather than relying on extra-regional currencies, Mercosur, a South American trade bloc, should create better compensation mechanisms at a shared unit of transaction for commerce. He also said that regional development banks should do more to finance social and economic projects. Lula made the remarks at a summit of the Union of South American Nations that has brought together leaders and representatives of the 12-member bloc to the Brazilian capital, Brasilia. North Korea's attempt to launch its first military reconnaissance satellite has ended in failure, with a rocket crashing into the sea off the west coast of the peninsula. The state media cited instability in the engine and fuel system for the failure, saying the rocket's second stage malfunctioned. It added Pyongyang will verify the defects and conduct a second launch soon. The satellite launch attempt prompted emergency alerts and brief evacuation warnings in some parts of South Korea and Japan. The South Korean military said it identified an object presumed to be part of the North Space Launch Vehicle. That's a wrap for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
A year after the Zionist regime killed the Palestinian-American journalist, an FBI probe remains pending, yet the U.S. has gone silent on her death. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Intercept reported, over the last year, Abu Akleh's colleagues have continued to report on Israeli regime violence across occupied Palestine, including increasingly frequent military invasions of West Bank cities like the one she was covering the day she was killed. They have also found themselves at the center of the story, regularly updating the public about the various probes into their colleagues' death while actively participating in global calls for justice. No one has been held accountable for Abu Akleh's killing to date, Last fall, the FBI launched an investigation following a sustained public pressure campaign, including by members of Congress. That probe is ongoing. Meanwhile, the Office of the U.S. Security Coordinator for the Zionist Regime and the Palestinian Territories, the Liaison on Security Issues in the Region, has delayed issuing its own report into the killing. Along with Abu Aghele's family, Al Jazeera has filed a formal request to investigate the killing to the International Criminal Court, whose probe into an array of crimes committed in Palestine has not made much progress since it was launched in 2021. As those probes stall, many of Abu Aghele's colleagues still struggle to cope with the void she left. When Abu Aghele was shot on May 11, 2022, she was wearing a clearly marked press vest in an area with no active fighting between the Zionist regime forces and Palestinians. In the weeks following her killing, half a dozen independent reviews, including one by the United Nations, found that the Zionist regime forces were responsible. Last July, Palestinian human rights groups Al-Haq and the UK-based research agency Forensic Architecture released a detailed reconstruction of the shooting, which concluded that Abu Aghele had been deliberately targeted by the Zionist regime forces. While the killing sparked significant international condemnation, it was hardly an isolated incident. According to the UN report, last year was the deadliest for Palestinians in the West Bank since the end of the Second Intifada in early 2000s. This year is on track to be worse, as Israeli regime forces make military incursions into cities like Nablus and Jenin with increasing frequency. According to the UN, Israeli regime forces have already killed at least 94 Palestinians this year, including at least 19 children, more than double last year's number in the same period. As The Intercept reported last year, the U.S. government never investigated the Zionist regime's killing of 23-year-old peace activist Rachel Corey, who was crushed to death with a bulldozer while protesting a home demolition in Gaza 20 years ago, nor of 78-year-old Omar Assad, a former Milwaukee grocery store owner who died of a heart attack last year while in custody of a notoriously violent Israeli regime military unit. The U.S. Justice Department's investigation into Abu Aghele's death, which came only after serious outrage at U.S. inaction in the case, marked the first time the U.S. government moved to independently probe the Zionist regime's killing of an American. As a standard with criminal investigations by the FBI, Justice Department officials have not spoken publicly about the case. The Justice Department did not respond to a request for comment. Abu Aghele was not the first journalist killed by Zionist regime forces. In a report published recently, the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, documented at least 20 instances of Israeli forces killing members of the media since 2001. Like Abu Aghele, the majority of those killed, at least 13, were clearly identified as journalists or inside vehicles with press in Sinai when they were killed, according to the report. Many more journalists were injured by Zionist regime forces, which also repeatedly targeted media headquarters. During a military assault on Gaza in 2021, for instance, the Israeli regime bombed buildings where more than a dozen local and international media outlets were headquartered, including the Associated Press and Al Jazeera. As The Intercept has previously reported, the Zionist regime also regularly detains and questions Palestinian journalists, including 16, who are currently being held without charges. To be a journalist in Palestine is a very dangerous job, said Ammar Al-Duaik, the director of the Independent Commission for Human Rights, Palestine's National Human Rights Institute, adding that journalists also face daily intimidation by Zionist settlers and troops. Al-Duaik, who was a colleague of Abu Aghla, said that her killing was a reminder that nobody was safe from Israeli regime violence and that journalists were no exception. He said Shirin was visible in the broad daylight. The troops could see her wearing the vest and yet they shot her, which means that no one is safe and everyone could be a target. Being a journalist doesn't give you any protection with Israeli troops. Nor has being a clearly identifiable journalist led to greater accountability.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Another misunderstanding between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, reportedly has been resolved. This, as it appears, a technical issue related to one of the Iranian sites has been taken care of. Iran continues its cooperation with the IAEA, but has cut back on some of its voluntary cooperation due to the United States totally leaving the JCPOA nuclear deal in 2018. However, despite Tehran's cooperation, there always seems to be some accusation by the IAEA of the Islamic Republic not abiding by its responsibilities. What is the reality? Stay with us as we take a look at this and more on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Daniel Kovalek, professor of international human rights, University of Pittsburgh, School of Law, out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And Shabir Rezvi, political analyst, out of London. Thank you both for being with me. Well, Dan, I'd like to start off with you. I mean, there are reports that two of the most recent concerns by the IAEA have been resolved or clarified. Do you think that Tehran tries to cooperate with the IAEA, or do you see Iran lacking in trying to cooperate with the organization?
I think they do try to cooperate with the organization. And honestly, I don't really know why, I mean, given that it never satisfies anyone. It never, you know, leads to reduced sanctions. But yeah, I do think Iran, you know, acts in a very honorable way regarding the nuclear issue. Again, even though it has no obligation to do so, even though the U.S. unilaterally backed out of the nuclear deal, as was mentioned 5 years ago, and yet Iran continues to cooperate.
Hmm. Well, Shabir, what about there? There seems to be continuous concern for the agency, by the agency, when it comes to Iran. When one issue is resolved, there seems to be another which appears. Do you think this is the case or not? And if so, why is this the case?
Hello, good evening.
Good evening.
Look, at the end of the day, I have many times been speaking on this matter and commented that the reality is that, as our colleague from Pittsburgh said, that it's really quite surprising that Iran continues to cooperate when they really don't get any mileage. One after another, issues are raised. And really, the whole nuclear issue, in my view, has been really a red herring because Iran has continuously, over the last 20-odd years, said that they are not interested in having nuclear weapons. They do not believe nuclear weapons provide any security to any nation. And they are emphatically of the view that nuclear weapons should be disbanded. So it's not really on the agenda of the Islamic Republic to have nuclear weapons. But what is important is that the IAEA and the Western powers use their leverage really for Iran not to have any defensive armament industry developed. Because recently, in the last few days, Iran tested the 2,000-kilometer ballistic missile. That, I think, is what is on the agenda, is really to disarm Iran in one way or another, leaving aside the nuclear issue, because you know, Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, has quite clearly stated that nuclear weapons are against Islam. You know, when it comes to other issues, they sort of take the speeches or the rulings of the religious scholars as sort of dangerous and extremist. But on this particular issue, when it has been continuously reiterated and explained to the Western powers that Iran is just not interested in nuclear weapons, they want to use it for civilian purposes, and which they have a right under all kinds of international rules and regulations that they can continue to do so. So whether it's for medical or other areas of civilian use, which are allowed within the current rules.
Well, Dan, how is it that Tehran is constantly being pressured and even threatened, but when the U.S. left the JCPOA, nothing was really done, nor did Washington have to pay any compensations for not sticking with its obligations? Your take on that and possible double standards in the IAEA?
Well, there's a lot of double standards here. Of course, we have also Israel that is a non-declared nuclear power with anywhere between 100 to 200, you know, nuclear warheads. We don't know how many because, again, they haven't declared it, but it's the worst-kept secret in the world that they have them, and they're not sanctioned at all. But, you know, again, we don't have a rule of law in the world. We have a rule of the mighty against, you know, the weaker countries, and the U.S. has all the military power, and, of course, it's backing Israel, and so that's why they are not sanctioned. It comes down to that, really.
Hmm. Well, Shabir, do you think the agency is acting like an independent entity? Because Iran continues to tell the IAEA to not let themselves be politically manipulated. Your thoughts?
Well, this is the whole problem, that whether it's IAEA or other United Nations agencies, they really are instruments of Washington, and reality, all the sort of Western powers coalesce together with Washington on matters of this nature. So whether you take the Human Rights Body, you take the International Monetary Fund, or the World Bank, or whatever, any entity, as I said, which runs under the auspices or otherwise, really carries the line of the Washington consensus, which is really to sort of control and manipulate poorer nations, nations that are unable to stand up to the might of the United States.
But I think what's also interesting is that, you know, Mr. Pompeo famously said that we lie, we cheat, and we steal. And not only that, we have a manual at the CIA to teach the cadets, and people were clapping and laughing. So that, I think, clearly shows that America and her allies lie continuously, they cheat continuously, and they steal from the poorer nations. So at the end of the day, the policy that Iran has adopted is to engage, at the same time also having the integrity to stand by its own dignity and try to manage the difficult situations that have been created due to sanctions and the manipulation of the international agencies.
Well, Dan Shabir brought up an interesting point about basically all of the organizations under the guise of the United Nations. It was created to prop up American hegemony. With that being the case, when you have certain situations, let's take the nuclear situation, we're dealing with that. I mean, what should independent countries do? Because, of course, they're going to try to use their leverage, and they will sanction, or they will, so many things that they will try to implement, if not abiding. So your thoughts on the option, the alternative of what should be done?
There's not a lot of options. That's the problem. You know, for countries that aren't as strong as the United States, and that's most countries of the world, if they act afoul of, you know, U.S. desires, whatever those may be in any given instance, they you know, risk having economic sanctions leveled against them, maybe even military action against them. And again, when you have a power like the U.S. that has the power of the sword, as we say, the power to punish other countries many times have to, you know, essentially bend to the will of the United States. And it's irrelevant what the law is. It's irrelevant what the United Nations says or any U.N. body. They just have to capitulate, whether they think that's correct or not. You know, you had this case, it should be mentioned, I think it was a couple of years ago, Iran won a case at the International Court of Justice, at least won it in part, saying some of the sanctions the U.S. has against Iran are illegal. And so the U.S. simply said, okay, we're not going to honor that decision. And by the way, we're going to just pull out generally of the ICJ, and, you know, we're going to use it when we want to and not be subject to it when we don't. You know, so again, there's no rule of law, and countries basically have to endure what they have to endure, sadly.
Mm. Well, Shabir, at the end of the day, do you think the real goal of the West is to try to prevent Iran from advancing technologically?
Well, that's very clear. That has been the intention for the last 43 years. And if you look at the history of the last 43 years, that it has had continuous sanctions that have been applied so that it cannot progress economically, it cannot progress militarily, is unable to sort of create intellectual capital. But the remarkable thing is that Iran has continued to progress with all the sanctions that have been applied in the last 43 years. And, you know, it's quite incredible that it continues to progress in this manner, no matter what Washington and Washington's vassal states, want to do. But what one has to really evaluate is that, yes, USA does have a sword, and it does wield that sword continuously, either through economic sanctions, diplomatic sanctions, perhaps even military sanctions, regime change. These are the tools that are available within the arsenal that USA has. But, you know, what's happening globally, geopolitically and geoeconomically in the last year, 2 years, shows very clearly that what I call the vulnerable nations of the world, and that includes Russia, China, India, you know, big nations, powerful nations in their own right, are really Brazil, South Africa, they're all saying that in reality, what we have to do is to get together so that we can really stand up to the USA, because otherwise what USA does is sort of eliminate one particular nation and then move on to the other one. Yeah. However, when the Southern Hemisphere countries decide to work together, that I think would be a real challenge, and it is proving to be a challenge to the U.S. might.
Well, Dan, about trying to prevent Iran from advancing technologically, according to Shabir, the reality is that they have not been able to do that. So after more than 40 years of trying to pressure Iran, and they see that Iran continues advancing, one would think that perhaps they would try another method, because obviously that one hasn't worked. But we continue to see the same old, same old. I mean, why is that the case in your perspective?
Well, wasn't it Albert Einstein that said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and hoping for different results?
Right.
I think our leaders are insane. I mean, I'm sorry, they're not acting in any rational capacity. You know, Iran is willing to deal with the United States. It helped in the war on terror. And after the war on terror, Iran sent a proposal to the White House, proposing a grand bargain with the United States to try to deal with all the issues of mutual concern, and the U.S. never even responded to it. The fact is, the U.S. could work with Iran if it wanted to, and that would be the rational decision here. Instead, they continue to try to punish Iran, frankly, for having overthrown the U.S.-backed dictator in 1979, you know, but this is not a rational policy. It's a policy of spite, a policy motivated by the desire for control. And given that, the U.S. just keeps moving forward with the same failed policies.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Shabir, how much of the U.S. policies do you think, when we're looking at, whether we're talking about the relationship with Iran or specifically in dealing with the IAEA nuclear talks, how much do you think that the Zionist regime plays in all of this? That Washington is not particularly looking at what's perhaps best even for the American people or the United States, but more importantly, the interests of the regime in Tel Aviv?
Well, indeed, that is the reality of the situation, is that the Zionist entity is a colonial sort of project, which was implanted by my government, by the British government, way back, nearly 100 years ago, when the Balfour Declaration was proposed. And under that auspices, the Zionist entity came into creation in 1948. And of course, American presidents continuously since that time have sort of put all the support that is required to sort of take away any blame from the rulers in Tel Aviv, whether it's the killing of Palestinians. I mean, since the beginning of this year, virtually every day an individual Palestinian has been killed and assassinated in the occupied territories. Recently, we had bombing taking place in Gaza, and this seems to be a sort of a regular feature every year. It continues. And I think the most telling comment really is from Netanyahu himself. Only recently, he said 95% of the threat to Israel comes from Iran. So, you know, when the leader of a nation says that the main threat is from Israel, from Iran, then that shows clearly that the U.S. wants to protect Israel. And if tomorrow, let's say, you know, when the Reza Shah Pahlavi was in power, Iran had very good relationship with Israel, and oil was being supplied at a discounted rate. But as soon as Imam Khomeini came into power, that relationship was completely cut off. And that in itself has created huge problems for Iran. If tomorrow Iran decides to, have diplomatic relationships with Israel, then nuclear weapons, human rights issues, all kinds of things will be put on the back burner, and Iran would become part of the so-called, group of civilized nations.
Dan, how much of this is related to the hegemonic media there? We talked about, Shabir talked about the Israeli regime, and we talked about as far as the interests of Tel Aviv perhaps being more important sometimes to Washington than the United States itself. But isn't the reality is that the people of the United States have no idea of the reality, whether we're talking about Israel and Israeli crimes, whether we're talking about Iran and actually abiding by their commitments, or whether we're talking about the United States itself and not really abiding by its commitments. It is the reality is that the populace in the United States is extremely ignorant of the reality. Thus, no pressure actually is exerted against the government.
Well, of course, that's true. Americans are, I would say, uniquely ignorant in the world about many things, about history, about their own history, certainly world history, geography. Many Americans couldn't even find Iran on the map or even Israel on the map. You know, after 9/11, there was a popular country song where the singer says he doesn't know the difference between Iran and Iraq, and he said it proudly, you know. When you have that situation, an uninformed populace, of course, they won't push back on any of this because they have no idea about the long history, again, of the U.S. supporting the murderous Shah in Iran. They don't know why there was a revolution in 1979. They don't know that Iran has helped in the war on terror. They just know nothing. And given that, yeah, it's very hard for change to come to the United States.
You know, Dan, you just said something. I remember once I was in the States and actually at university and showing some slides on Iran, and this was on a university setting, and someone was surprised to know that people actually live in houses and buildings. They were thinking that they lived in, like, deserts. Like, it was quite unbelievable to that level of a lack of knowledge of the reality of what happens in other countries. Well, Shabir, you've pointed to this, alluded to this earlier, about the rise of this multilateral world. There's the unilateral world is ending, and we're entering a new phase. Your perspective on how much this will change the reality on the ground, whether we're talking about IAEA or other organizations under the United Nations, because there is going to be a different dynamic, and it's already in the making. Your take.
Well, indeed, new dynamics is in the making. Obviously, because the whole sort of web that USA has created after the Second World War of United Nations, other organizations, as I've said, money sort of transferring through SWIFT, the banking system, and all sort of instruments that have been created, it's not easy technically to come out of that. But I think a great effort is being made by whether it's the BRIC countries or SCO or the Eurasian nations together to really challenge this hegemonic madness, if you like, whereby a particular nation feels that they have special rights
and no one else has any other rights at all. And I think people have been really trying to create the situation for many years, but it was becoming difficult. However, we can see that lots of things have happened since the Ukraine war and sanctions on Russia, and then, of course, the whole issue of Taiwan and China, and continuously it carries on to sort of create this sort of war situation, a continuous sort of war footing that Washington wants to sort of have, because obviously it benefits the armaments trade and the military-industrial complex. But I think people of the world have really awakened that what is happening is not in their interest. And really, the situation is that only 15% of the global population lives in countries like the European Union, United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. 85% of the world population does not live in that particular region. And they have been deprived, manipulated, and the governments have been changed through color revolutions and all kinds of other manipulations. So I think we are living through extraordinary times, not just interesting times, but extraordinary times where things are moving so rapidly that even analysts and commentators can't really keep pace with it. But I think it's a good omen for the world global population.
Okay. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. Daniel Kovalek, professor of international human rights, University of Pittsburgh School of Law, out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. By the way, Dan, nice picture behind your head, like the painting. Shabir Rezvi, political analyst out of London. And as always, I appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
السلام عليك يا أبا جعفر محمد بن علي البر التميم.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the 9th divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. This great Imam was one of the founders of the jurisprudence of the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all. He was one of the founders of the very jurisprudence of the Ahlul Bayt that represented creation, originality, and the progress of intellect. Scholars have reported from Imam al-Jawad a wonderful variety of wisdom and literature regarding noble deeds and conducts that are among the most precious maxims dealing with different educational and moral and ethical issues.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are humbly talking about the dialogues of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad al-Taqi alayhi salam. So, dear friends, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, of course, lived in an era which was filled by moral and ethical decadence, but it was also filled with political and social decay. So what's really interesting is that the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, we find that they say that the people will be influenced and affected by the religion of their leaders. And it's interesting, this is also what we see in the present day, where different kind of leaders or presidents or prime ministers come into power, and the effect of the personality of that leader is many a time reflected amongst the people. The philosophy of the president, the ideology of the president, the overall behaviors, ways of speaking of the person who is the leader is, somehow reflected on the people, and it has an effect on the people. And so here we find that the Abbasid caliphs, of course, themselves were not the most religious of people, to say the least. They were not the most pious people or the most knowledgeable people. And so these kind of things, seeped and diffused into the society in general. Here we find that there is an interesting conversation where they are talking about certain aspects, and then, one of the companions asks a specific question, about, when does one know when the time is ready for something, right? And so Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam replies, he says that showing something before it becomes complete spoils that thing. Now, it does seem like a general statement, but one of the ways that this response of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam can be interpreted and understood is that in the political or social arena, when you have a certain political or social idea, that you should really wait for it to become complete. You should wait for it, you know, to be all-rounded, comprehensive, take all of the different, aspects into consideration, take all the different variables into consideration, especially when you're coming up with a political